What is the meaning?
This music from Jim Cole, his song, What's in a Name? 9 minutes after the hour, it's Wednesday morning here, a winsome Wednesday along the Broken Road. And we're joined by Doug Greenwald. Doug, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times in Columbia, Maryland, on the very outskirts of Washington, D.C. And Doug joins us, Preserving Bible Times, what they do see is put context back into Scripture. And so we're looking forward to an extensive discussion this morning. Doug has some ideas that might ruffle your feathers today concerning discipleship. Doug, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing well, thank you. I'm about to get on an airplane tomorrow morning and head south to New Orleans. I'm hopeful that the azaleas will be out in the Garden District, and we'll have a lovely time.
Well,
all right.
I hope so too. Do a little seafood down there, and
hopefully a lot of seafood.
Creole stuff. Yeah, yeah.
No,
yeah.
Not going to get meatloaf at these places.
Well, that's unfortunate, but you got to come to a place like East Coast to get meatloaf in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'll be there in the following week.
That's true.
I'll have my choice of bison loaf and elk loaf. Well, and could have whatever loaves they have.
Black bear loaf could be.
We have a state food called gopher loaf.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, we're full.
Not really sure what's in it.
We're a state of expert loafers. We do that a lot.
We have lots of loafers here.
Yeah.
The meatloaf's on the roadkill menu.
Well, right, darn, how'd you
roadkill
know?
Roadkill grill. Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before we get into your topic, Doug, I was watching the election yesterday. And the polls ahead of time said, no, it's going to be close. And it reminded me a great deal of the elections in this country. And I would not be surprised to find out that it was Barack, the first henchman that went over and did the push polling, you know, involved in the Israeli election. You spent a lot of time in Israel. You got any insights?
Well, I found it fascinating that the speculation on this side of the Atlantic was that the election was going to be a referendum on Netanyahu's policies or postures or whether it was a good or a bad idea to have come to the United States to speak to the Congress, et cetera, et cetera. But when I talked to my Israeli friends over there just a couple of weeks ago, I said, well, what do you think of Netanyahu's chances are? And the answer was that they'd really be good if it wasn't for his wife.
Oh. Ms. Netanyahu. I don't know.
And I said, well, what's the that all about? Oh, he says, her sense of entitlement, her abusiveness with the public, her arrogance, da-di-da-di-da-di-da. That's what the Israeli people just can't stomach much anymore. Really? And so the fact that he is either tie or one seat ahead of Herzog, despite the anti-charisma of his wife.
Anti-charisma,
really,
that's a good
statement
word.
That like there that. Must be people willing to overlook a whole lot to support him. So I think the emphasis has been missed a little bit.
Mm. Well, according to reports this morning, he ended up with a six seat majority over his nearest competitor, the Herzog's party.
Oh, really? It was just either tie or one when I went to bed last night.
30 seats out of 120 has gone to the Likud. This last-minute surge it talks about that brought him ahead. And I guess in a parliamentary system, 30 out of 120 or 25% of the vote is considered pretty respectable.
Well, it puts you in the driver's seat for forming the coalition.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I would say he's probably going to continue on as the fourth prime minister in this sequence of elections here in recent years. But anyway, context always matters. And I really thought it fascinating here in the West that maybe they didn't recognize all the dynamics that are at work. And now that he actually has 30 seats, given the boat anchor that his wife was, I think speaks even more to the ratification of his policy.
The boat anchor, anti-charisma. My vocabulary is expanding here this morning.
Now have you met Mrs. Beebe?
Oh, no. She's above people like me.
No. She's that tall.
Cause, she is that way, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard that.
That's the word. So.
Okay.
There was one piece of footage that I saw yesterday where it said that Beebe gave his wife a kiss from the stage. And I looked at the stage, and he's in the middle next to the microphone, and she's got to be 8 feet away. I mean, there's nobody else at the stage at all. The whole, all these open seats, but she's off in the next county. I mean, she's a long ways away. It's almost like they're visually trying to put her away from the main speaker, the guy in the picture.
Only David would notice something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that, I found that interesting. That you know, they, you know, in this country, you grab the missus, you pull her close,
well,
because your family values and all that stuff.
You may have your answer for that observation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. But it, you know, he said he was going to give her a big kiss, but then I noticed he didn't do it.
Yeah, okay.
Probably would have lost him two seats.
Could have been. Doug Greenwald publishes a monthly news reflection. It's a newsletter that you can get in your email. It's free, and it's a delight. I look forward to my copy of it every single month. This last one was a barn burner, Doug. You talked about discipleship. You said it's dead, or at least on life support. Hmm. What's going on with discipleship?
Well, you know, I've been full-time in this world of biblical context for 15 years now and had the opportunity and God's grace to travel many places, speak with many people, do a lot of listening, have fascinating dinners with pastoral staffs, et cetera, et cetera. And if the mood is right and the moment is a good one, and it seems like an appropriate discussion, I will ask, how's it going here, making disciples? And I never get a good answer to that question. And no one ever says it's going terrific. No one ever says it's exceeding our expectations. What you do get is the converse of that. Well, it's not going very well. Actually, we're frustrated and disappointed. And that is so universal. Did you notice what Jesus was doing in this encounter in the Gospels, or that encounter as he was working with the disciples? And I would be making contextual observations, sort of being up at 5,000 feet, looking down at the process that Jesus was using. And 9 out of 10 times I got the answer back, no, I hadn't thought about that. Hadn't seen that. And so that caused me to write my book maybe 10 years ago, Making Disciples Jesus' Way, Wisdom We Have Missed. And it's been, in our little modest world here, a bestseller. It's the book that we sell the most copies of. It seems to scratch where some people are itching. And it's the only thematic book I've ever written. Usually, as you know, I'm writing about passages. I love passage development. I love contextually restoring passages. But I keep getting drawn back into this thematic circle of making disciples, or our Western world for it these days, discipleship. And so periodically, I'll publish something, write something, share something. And not too long ago, I was invited to lead some workshops at an international holistic missions conference down in the western part of the country in a couple months. And I thought, what's an interesting way to kick that workshop or those workshops off with? And it came to me, well, why don't you put out a list, 20 reasons why the discipleship patient died? Make it sort of an autopsy kind of thing. Because from my time in the medical world, doctors will always tell you there's no such thing as a legitimate therapy unless you've got the diagnosis 90% right. So 90% of an effective therapy when it comes to making disciples has to be rooted in a sound diagnosis. And so I thought, well, I'll put 20 diagnostic reasons out there that could be the reason that the Western discipleship patient has died, or if you prefer, on life support. And, you know, that's always risky. And I thought, well, this may stir up some dust. I may get more cancellations from this newsletter than I probably have aggregate over the years from my other passage kinds of contextual reflections. And so I sent it out. Actually, less than a week ago, I sent it out last Friday noon. So what do you think happened? What do you think the reception was?
Well, based upon my own reaction, a lot of questions, a lot of interest, rather intense interest, actually. This is a provocative way to approach the topic, and I think you provoked some response, is my guess.
Actually, we got more opens. I'm on a system that allows me to track what happens, so I'm not guessing at these statistics here. There were more opens, email opens, in a shorter window of time than any newsletter we have yet done. This particular newsletter was forwarded to more people than any newsletter we have ever done. And it generated more direct response back to us here via email from people who I thought, I wonder what the vote's going to be. And it was 100% zero. At least 100% of the people responding said they really liked it. They appreciated it. They had very nice things to say about it. And nobody torpedoed it or was angry with it. Now, that doesn't mean there weren't people who weren't angry. I don't want to fall in the trap of counting just the yes responses here. But in the aggregate, that particular little newsletter, 20 Reasons Why the Discipleship Patient Died, has had more reaction, more positive responses, more forwarding to other people than anything we've ever done. Now, what do you make of that?
Well, you've hit a nerve.
That's my conclusion. It's resonating with people. And I asked people to feed back to me which they thought the top five causative factors were of the list of 20. And a goodly number of people did that. There is no consensus, which I found fascinating. But I think that's understandable. Everyone tends to respond within the context of their own experience. Their experiences have been different. They've experienced different causative factors, and so you would expect them to latch on and nominate the ones that spoke most to them.
Well, you know, if I could summarize the 20 and encapsulate it, it would be with a simple statement: is we don't know what direction to go in. So you would expect a diverse response pattern, I would think, like that, because nobody's on the same wavelength here. We're not on the same page with respect to discipleship. I don't think we know what a real disciple looks like.
And that's one of the 20 causative factors that I nominated. We just don't understand what a first century disciple looks like. And you say, now, why would I phrase it that way? Why have I tied it to the first century? Well, when Jesus said, go and make disciples, we're in the first century. We have a rabbi, Yeshua, Jesus, who is speaking in a Semitic dialect to other Jews. And therefore, the word make and the word disciple has to have a very specific first century meaning. And if we don't start there, if we don't know what a biblical disciple looks like, then what in the world, how would we know what to make? So I think you've touched on a real significant contributing factor here. You know, in those conversations over the last 15 years, that I've been privileged to have with parachurch ministry people and pastors and staff, if it's appropriate and if I think it flows, I'll ask the question, what do you think 6 or 8 of the essential attributes of a biblical disciple are? And I can pull them out of the gospel record. There are 8. And the best answer I've ever gotten is 3, and usually I get just 1. So, you know, if most people can identify only 1 of 8 essential attributes of a biblical disciple, it kind of does raise the question, doesn't it? How do we know what to make? What's the target? What's the objective?
Well, without a roadmap, we don't know what we're trying to get to, what the end result will be, how we would picture success. Even and we talk frequently about our Greek Western trained mindset here, where we're analytical and we divide things and we pick them apart and then try to put them back together. You've got to know where the destination is in order to pick a route, and I'm not sure we know what the destination is. You know, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dave.
Are these 8 attributes hidden well in the scriptures, and nobody else has been able to find them except you?
I don't think so. I think they're all over the pages of the Gospels.
Okay. I mean, it's something that seems to be fairly obvious that maybe even there should be seminary classes about this sort of thing.
Well, let's peel the onion back just a little bit here. until you get into the world of context, you're probably not going to recognize them. Because they're just a natural part of the fabric of the first century rabbi-disciple world. But if you don't understand that world, you're probably not going to see them. And so we lapse into our default position here in the West, and we pull up this word called mentoring. And at best, we have some soft form of mentoring as our strategy for making disciples. And the data would seem to suggest that's not working very well. In fact, you know, you really don't want to take my opinion for things. I mean, who am I? So let me quote Dallas Willard. Mm-hmm. Non-discipleship is the elephant in the church. It's a huge animal sitting in our narthex, and everyone is dancing around it, and nobody's doing anything about it. Now, cut me some slack on hyperbole. When I say nobody is doing, I'm sure at the 5 or 10% level, there are people out there who are doing discipling the right way. But at the 90% level, it's not working. It's hit and miss. And it's mostly miss.
Is there an obligation to make disciples? I know that's a nervy question in front of the whole world, but is that what we're supposed to be doing?
Well,
you know, intentionally making disciples?
Though, let's peel that apart, because that's a fascinating question. We have this notion called the Great Commission, right?
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a mandate, doesn't it? Doesn't that sound like a command?
It does. Like,
that's something we have to do.
What a commission means, yeah.
What if I told you in the Greek, in the original language, it really reads more like this: as you were going on your way, of course you will be making disciples. And I would suggest to you that's how it reads.
That makes the primary mission to go on your way, then. That's what we're supposed to be about. In other words, bringing good
news. As you were going on your way, of course you will be making disciples.
Well, what's he telling us to do with that?
It's the great given. Mm. It's not the great commission. It's the great assumption.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've had this discussion before, right? What do apple trees do?
Well, they grow apples.
They make apples, right?
Yeah,
they make apples.
And orchard owners don't have to have a campaign every spring with banners all over the orchard say, come on, apple trees, let's make apples this year. That's what apple trees do. They make apples.
It's the nature of the tree. So you're saying it's the nature of a disciple, a real disciple, to make disciples.
He doesn't need to be exhorted to do it. He doesn't need to be commanded to do it. It's what disciples do.
Mm-hmm.
So we are so far amiss of understanding that dynamic that we've got a long way to go to come back.
Yeah, and we talked about this division we've made in, you call it the discipleship baby here, that we divided it in half. Explain that idea.
Well, we have to go back to the way that the Western mind works and the way that the Jewish mind works. And the Jewish mind, by the way, is the world of the Gospels, the world of the Old Testament. In the Jewish way of thinking, it's always about fusion. It's about synthesis. It's about keeping things together. The Western mind is the antithesis of that. It loves to do analysis. It loves to divide things up. It loves to do dissection. It loves to then put labels on each of the pieces that it dissects. And it erroneously concludes that if I can label all the pieces appropriately, I've mastered the subject. And so Jesus never used the word evangelism, and he never used the word discipleship. It's always controversial when I say to people, those are non-biblical words. I mean, try to find them in Strong's exhaustive concordance. They don't exist. They're not there. They're words we've invented in the West because we weren't happy with just using the phrase make disciples, which in the Jewish worldview was a seamless entity, okay? No beginning, no end, no two parts. We came to this seamless baby that was never intended to be divided, and we cut this baby in half. Even Solomon was smart enough not to cut the baby in half. And then, because we love to dissect and create new labels and words, we cut the baby in half and called part one, evangelism, a new word. And the other half that was left, we call that discipleship. And the danger, of course, when you create new words is you can give them your own meaning. That's part of what plagues us as well. And so now that we've cut the making disciples baby in half into two parts, evangelism and discipleship, now we can make choices. We can make priorities. We can give emphasis to one over the other. And that's literally what we've done. And because all things considered, evangelism is easier to do than 30 years of discipleship. I mean, sometimes you can save a person in 5 minutes or less, right? Mm-hmm. That's what they try to do at Beach Week during spring break, some of these paraprofessional ministries. We've emphasized saving people, and because of the lifestyles we lead and because we've taken our eye off the ball, we don't have much time left to disciple people, but by goodness, at least we saved them. And that, in large part, I think, explains the malady, the situation we currently find ourselves in.
Well, but then you have a clearly, again, this is my Western brain thinking, you have a clearly defined beginning and an outcome. The person says, okay, I believe, I love Jesus. What's next?
And then it's hard to have a clearly defined outcome when you're discipling someone over 30 years, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
It's like a slalom skier going down the hill. You know, it's first one side and then the other side. I'm going to mix my metaphors here. It's sometimes two steps backwards and one step forward. It can be messy. It can be frustrating. It's not clean and neat. And so we just sort of throw up our hands and say, well, at least we saved them.
I've had with, don't get me started on the problems with life that I've had. But one of the problems I've had with life and relating to other people is that other people seem to want a plan. And, you know, and I've constantly gotten advice, you know, in high school and college and, you know, put your resume together and do this, take this step and call Ed and then go in and make sure you wear this suit and all of the plans of life. And I've always rejected that. I want to live life as it comes. I want to, you know, take the swing off the tee and then I'll play the ball from where it lands as opposed to plan where it's supposed to be. And that's, I'm kind of seeing that as a metaphor for the lifelong discipling that you're talking about, that you don't necessarily have a list of objectives that by week 38, you're supposed to have been able to memorize the 14th passage of whatever book. You know, you just kind of go along and progress from the step you had yesterday to go further, and whatever further means.
Let me paraphrase this for Doug. Doug, is it Jewish? Is it Middle Eastern nature to be living life in the moment, or are they constantly looking ahead to next month, next year, next generation?
Need to always be mindful of the fact that there are ditches on both sides of every road.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just heard ditches on both sides of a road articulated, all right? And we're actually called to live in the middle. Life in the first century in the gospel period was very tenuous. It took five people working 24/7 from an agrarian perspective to feed six people during a year. 90% of the people are dirt poor, living on the edge of poverty. So a lot of the focus, it's hard to plan when you're not sure 90 days out whether you're even going to be in debtor's prison or not. You're just one drought removed. You're just one insect infestation removed from a disaster. So, I mean, that is one level to it here. But at the same time, we have to fuse together other thoughts. Remember when Jesus said, count the cost?
Yes.
That's planning. That's pre-thinking. That's looking down the road. That's understanding what's required. That's making sure you've got the appropriate commitment and appropriate resources to get from A to B. So Jesus is not anti-planning. He exhorts his disciples to count the cost of following him, to look down the road and understand the implications. So I think we're touching on another issue here, is that the Western mind has a very difficult time with paradox. Something is and something isn't all at the same time. Whereas the Jewish mind, the Eastern mind, says, oh, no problem. Yeah. And so we need to think more Jewish, fusing two thoughts together that seem to be in juxtaposition rather than approaching things as either or. Look at them from both and.
That's tall.
So I don't think it's, I think it's an artificial distinction to say spontaneity versus planning. I think you got to take both those thoughts and fuse them together. You want to be very spontaneous in the midst of living out the plan.
I hate to say it, but I think I understand that. I haven't heard the book put it quite that way before. I'm comfortable.
Well, what
with
did
that
Rex Harrison say in My Fair Lady? By Jove, I think she's got it.
Yes. I like that. I like that. So 20 reasons, Doug. Let's go down the list a little bit here, but we still have some time to do this. Cause,
well, we haven't left one, so
yeah,
all right, let's go to two.
Yeah.
We've confused being a convert or a believer with being a disciple of Jesus. So we have been content to let people remain converts or to say, yeah, I'm a believer. But that's but a shadow of what it means to say, yes, I'm a disciple of Jesus. And of course, why would it work itself out that way? We don't understand what a disciple of Jesus is. And so we just blurred the distinctions and said, yeah, a disciple is one who's agreed to the Apostles' Creed.
Even better if you've got it memorized.
Yeah, or in some churches, if you can agree with most of the tenets of the Apostles' Creed.
If you're in the 60% range.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Well, again, not knowing what a disciple is has a lot to do with it. We kind of assume that because we're a believer, well, sure, we've earned the mantle disciple as well. We'd like to be like Jesus, but how do you do that?
We come in, invited by a church to do a Making Disciples Jesus Way weekend. Very early on in session number one, I do about a 15 or 20 minute role play where I start out in life as a 4-year-old Jewish boy. And I end up this role play having just spent 3 years with an esteemed rabbi walking the trail, okay? And I go through all the stages of my development and my worldview and how I look at rabbis and what I aspire to be. And then I ask the audience to break up in groups of 4 to 6 and document as best they can the 8 attributes of a biblical disciple that I've just lived out in this role play, okay? And the reason I do that is exactly the point you're making. Unless we're clear what a disciple of Jesus looks like, it's not obvious what we should be trying to replicate, emulate, reproduce. And so I think there's great confusion in what is a disciple of Jesus from an attribute point of view. And the sooner we get back to that, I think the sooner our compasses will start pointing due north again.
I think a lot of us define discipleship as a passionate commitment to Jesus, which is a very foggy kind of statement here that has to do with feelings and not so much a decision to do or to be something. It has to do with the way you feel. And so much of us fall back on our Christian faith on that basis of feeling. And I've maintained forever that faith is a decision. It's not a feeling. And if you wake up in a bad mood, are you no longer a Christian? If you're mad at somebody or you're no longer a Christian, well, your behavior may not be Christianly, but no, you're still a Christian if you have made the decision to follow Jesus. But then the next step is, where do I put my next foot?
There's a great quote that Lord Alfred North Whitehead, a British philosopher, mathematician, once made that I really resonate with. He said this, the only simplicity worth trusting is that which comes from the far side of complexity. In other words, simplicity that has not had to live through the weeds and deal with all the ambiguities and all the issues isn't worth trusting. It's overly simplistic simplicity. Okay? But it is helpful if you can get to the far side of complexity and distill it down and reduce it to its essence of what are the simple observations that make all of this work. And I want to give you my best efforts at this issue of making disciples, to try to boil it down after 15 years into three observations that may be helpful. And the reason this is queued up in my mind is because you just identified part of one of them, okay? So issue number one is, of the three issues when it comes to making disciples, issue number one is, do you know what a disciple of Jesus looks like? That's a knowledge question. And once you're clear what a disciple of Jesus looks like, do you want to become that? That's a passion commitment question. It's not so much a feeling issue, it's a passion issue. It's a deep desire issue. And once you know what a disciple of Jesus looks like and you've committed yourself that that's what you want to be, point number three, do you know how to get there? That's a process question. And so to do justice to the therapy side of our dilemma here of why the Western discipleship patient is on life support, we have to be clear what a disciple of Jesus looks like. We have to be clear that we're passionate, that that's what we want to become, and we have to know how to get there.
Is it okay to be just a believer and be content with that, or is that unnatural?
Is it okay to be an apple tree and not produce apples?
No. That would be unnatural.
I was just a rabbi to you. I didn't answer your question. I gave you a question and response.
Yes, you did.
A little Socratic thing going on there.
Yeah. Good point. So by claiming to be a believer, we should be willing to embark on that discipleship path. So it's incumbent upon us to find out what a disciple does look like.
It ought to be part of our spiritual DNA. Apple trees make apples. They don't make grapefruits.
Gotcha. Interesting stuff. Interesting, Doug. Well, this I don't want to leap ahead here, but this comes to your framework issue here too, as well as how we take all this information and put it into a comprehensible whole and a pattern, and then work within that to proceed.
See, then that's my thesis. Point three, process. Without a framework, it's very hard to be clear about the process. Let me end our time up here, because I see we have just a couple minutes left, with point number three of the 20 reasons why discipleship died. It ties into the previous two here. We assume that people will know how to make disciples. They don't. How can you pass along something you have not experienced?
One of the things that I did a number of years ago was mentor a kid going through confirmation for a friend of mine. Her son. And and we never had any classes on how we're supposed to do this. We're supposed to sit with the kid and then afterwards talk about the sermon, and most of the questions are on the page, and most of the questions are along the lines of what did they say in the 14th sentence of the third paragraph, what did the minister say when at the end of it, and then how do you feel about that? So, I mean, that's the depth of the understanding of it. And, you know, that doesn't sound like making disciples to me. It sounds like filling in for somebody, helping somebody do his homework.
Which leads to the question, where do the mentors come from? Where do we get this from?
And that's why I think we need yet another framework. one of the later points we'll get to. You've certainly set the stage for continuing this discussion. Part of our dilemma is there aren't many gray hairs around anymore who feel they're ready or competent enough to disciple a younger buck. And therefore, there's very little of what I'll call that vertical mentoring going on anymore. What do we do about that? Is there something we can do to replace that? I believe there is. It's called co-discipling or peer discipling. And with a good framework to give us insight into the process, we can now even open a subject called self-discipling. Because one of the things that the Western Church has failed to do is to challenge its people to take more responsibility for their own discipling. How can you do that if you don't have a framework, a roadmap, or a process? Okay. Mm-hmm. So those are all topical areas that we'll dig into in weeks to come.
Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. The website is Preserving Bible Times, all one word, all lowercase is fine, preservingbibletimes.org. And as I've said time and again, there are a wealth of resources for your church, for your Bible studies, for your small group, or just for your own individual study. You can learn a lot. Sign up, I would say. Sign up for that monthly reflection newsletter. And let it come to you and let it open some doors for you and provide some aha moments. That's what Doug is so good at doing week in and week out. You can link to the website right from ours if you're listening on Broken Road this morning. One click will get you there. Beautiful website, and I think you'll enjoy what you find and enjoy what you hear again next week when Doug joins us again on Wednesday. That'll be the day before you come here. You'll be flying next Wednesday.
It's also the day I'm in the air, so I got to check my flight schedule to see whether we can sneak this in before I have to run off to the airport.
Okay, well, we'll hope for Doug next week, and if not, we'll catch him in a couple of weeks. Doug, thanks so much. Appreciate having you around. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. See you next time.
Doug, as a parting remark, I pulled up the Haaretz. It's a website in Israel.
Uh-huh.
And the headline says, "From Camelot to Spamalot, why Mrs. Netanyahu is no Jackie Kennedy."
On that note...